T. Lobsang Rampa. The Third Eye. The Third Eye, originally published in 1956, this is where it all started, an autobiography about a young man's journey into becoming a medical lama and undergoing an operation to open the third eye. We are shown a glimpse into the Tibetan way of lamasery life and the deep understanding of spiritual knowledge. Until this point in time, lamasery life was unknown, even to those few who had actually visited Tibet. Lobsang enters the Chakporai Lamasery and learns the most secret of Tibetan esoteric sciences and much more. It is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Publishers foreword: the autobiography of a Tibetan Lama is a unique record of experience and, as such, inevitably hard to corroborate. In an attempt to obtain confirmation of the author's statements, the publishers submitted the MIST to nearly 20 readers, all persons of intelligence and experience, some with special knowledge of the subject. Their opinions were so contradictory that no positive result emerged. Some questioned the accuracy of one section, some of another. What was doubted by one expert was accepted unquestioningly by another. Anyway, the publishers asked themselves, was there any expert who had undergone the training of a Tibetan Lama in its most developed forms? Was there one who had been brought up in a Tibetan family? Lobsang Rampa has provided documentary evidence that he holds medical degrees of the University of Chongqing, and in those documents he is described as a Lama of the Potala Monastery of Lhasa. The many personal conversations we have had with him have proved him to be a man of unusual powers and attainments. Regarding many aspects of his personal life, he has shown a reticence that was sometimes baffling, but everyone has a right to privacy, and Lobsang Rampa maintains that some concealment is imposed on him for the safety of his family in communist-occupied Tibet. Indeed, certain details, such as his father's real position in the Tibetan hierarchy, have been intentionally disguised for this purpose. For these reasons, the author must bear and willingly bears a sole responsibility for the statements made in his book. We may feel that here and there he exceeds the bounds of Western credulity, though Western views on the subject here dealt with can hardly be decisive. Nonetheless, the publishers believe that The Third Eye is in its essence an authentic account of the upbringing and training of a Tibetan boy in his family and in a lamasery. It is in this spirit that we are publishing the book. Anyone who differs from us will, we believe, at least agree that the author is endowed to an exceptional degree with narrative skill and the power to evoke scenes and characters of absorbing and unique interest. Author's preface: I am a Tibetan, one of the few who have reached this strange Western world. The construction and grammar of this book leave much to be desired, but I have never had a formal lesson in the English language. My school of English was a Japanese prison camp, where I learned the language as best I could from English and American women prisoner patients. Writing in English was learned by trial and error. Now my beloved country is invaded, as predicted, by communist hordes. For this reason only I have disguised my true name and that of my friends. Having done so much against communism, I know that my friends in communist countries will suffer if my identity can be traced. As I have been in communist, as well as Japanese hands, I know from personal experience what torture can do, but it is not about torture that this book is written, but about a peace-loving country which has been so misunderstood and greatly misrepresented for so long. Some of my statements, so I am told, may not be believed. That is your privilege, but Tibet is a country unknown to the rest of the world. The man who wrote, of another country, that the people rode on turtles in the sea was laughed to scorn. So were those who had seen living fossil fish, yet the latter have recently been discovered and a specimen taken in a refrigerated airplane to the USA for study. These men were disbelieved. They were eventually proved to be truthful and accurate. So will I be. Rampa, written in the year of the wood sheep, chapter 1. Early days at home. O.E. 4 years old and can't stay on a horse. You'll never make a man. What will your noble father say? With this, old Tsu gave the pony, and luckless rider, a hearty thwack across the hind quarters, and spat in the dust. The golden roofs and domes of the Potala gleamed in the brilliant sunshine. Closer, the blue waters of the Serpent Temple Lake rippled to mark the passing of the waterfowl. From farther along the stony track came the shouts and cries of men urging on the slow-moving yaks just setting out from Lhasa. From nearby came the chest-shaking BMMN, BMMN, BMMN of the deep bass trumpets as monk musicians practiced in the fields away from the crowds. But I had no time for such everyday, commonplace things. Mine was the serious task of staying on my very reluctant pony. Nakim had other things in mind. He wanted to be free of his rider, free to graze, and roll and kick his feet in the air. Tsu was a grim and forbidding taskmaster. All his life he had been stern and hard, and now as guardian and riding instructor to a small boy of four, his patience often gave way under the strain. One of the men of calm, he, with others, had been picked for his size and strength. Nearly 7 feet tall he was, and broad with it. Heavily padded shoulders increased his apparent breadth. In eastern Tibet there is a district where the men are unusually tall and strong. Many were over 7 feet tall, and these men were picked to act as police monks in all the lamaseries. They padded their shoulders to increase their apparent size, blackened their faces to look more fierce, and carried long staves which they were prompt to use on any luckless malefactor. Tsu had been a police monk, but now he was dry nurse to a princeling. He was too badly crippled to do much walking, and so all his journeys were made on horseback. In 1904 the British, under Colonel Young Husband, invaded Tibet and caused much damage. Apparently they thought the easiest method of ensuring our friendship was to shell our buildings and kill our people. Tsu had been one of the defenders, and in the action he had part of his left hip blown away. My father was one of the leading men in the Tibetan government. His family, and that of mother, came within the upper 10 families, and so between them my parents had considerable influence in the affairs of the country. Later I will give more details of our form of government. Father was a large man, bulky, and nearly 6 feet tall. His strength was something to boast about. In his youth he could lift a pony off the ground, and he was one of the few who could wrestle with the men of calm and come off best. Most Tibetans have black hair and dark brown eyes. Was one of the exceptions. His hair was chestnut brown, and his eyes were grey. Often he would give way to sudden bursts of anger for no reason that we could see. We did not see a great deal of father. Tibet had been having troublesome times. The British had invaded us in 1904, and the Dalai Lama had fled to Mongolia, leaving my father and others of the cabinet to rule in his absence. 1909 the Dalai Lama returned to Lhasa after having been to Peking. In 1910 the Chinese, encouraged by the success of the British invasion, stormed Lhasa. The Dalai Lama again retreated, this time to India. The Chinese were driven from Lhasa in 1911 during the time of the Chinese Revolution, but not before they had committed fearful crimes against our people. In 1912 the Dalai Lama again returned to Lhasa. During the whole time he was absent, in those most difficult days, father and the others of the cabinet had the full responsibility of ruling Tibet. Mother used to say that father's temper was never the same after. Certainly he had no time for us children, and we at no time had fatherly affection from him. I, in particular, seemed to arouse his ire, and I was left to the scant mercies of Tsu to make or break. As father said, my poor performance on a pony was taken as a personal insult by Tsu. In Tibet small boys of the upper class are taught to ride almost before they can walk. Skill on a horse is essential in a country where there is no wheeled traffic, where all journeys have to be done on foot or on horseback. Tibetan nobles practice horsemanship hour after hour, day after day. They can stand on the narrow wooden saddle of a galloping horse, and shoot first with a rifle at a moving target, then change to bow and arrow. Sometimes skilled riders will gallop across the plains in formation, and change horses by jumping from saddle to saddle. At 4 years of age, found it difficult to stay in one saddle. Nakim was shaggy, and had a long tail. His narrow head was intelligent. He knew an astonishing number of ways in which to unseat an unsure rider. A favorite trick of his was to have a short run forward, then stop dead and lower his head. As I slid helplessly forward over his neck and onto his head, he would raise it with a jerk so that I turned a complete somersault before hitting the ground. Then he would stand and look at me with smug complacency. Tibetans never ride at a trot. The ponies are small and riders look ridiculous on a trotting pony. Times a gentle amble is fast enough, with the gallop kept for exercise. Tibet was a theocratic country. We had no desire for the progress of the outside world. We wanted only to be able to meditate and to overcome the limitations of the flesh. Our wise men had long realized that the West had coveted the riches of Tibet, and knew that when the foreigners came in, peace went out. Now the arrival of the communists in Tibet has proved that to be correct. My home was in Lhasa, in the fashionable district of Lhinka, at the side of the ring road which goes all round Lhasa, and in the shadow of the peak. There are three circles of roads, and the outer road, Lhinka, is much used by pilgrims. Like all houses in Lhasa, at the time I was born ours was two stories high at the side facing the road. No one must look down on the Dalai Lama, so the limit is two stories. As the height ban really applies only to one procession a year, many houses have an easily dismantled wooden structure on their flat roofs for 11 months or so. Our house was of stone and had been built for many years. It was in the form of a hollow square, with a large internal courtyard. Our animals used to live on the ground floor, and we lived upstairs. We were fortunate in having a flight of stone steps leading from the ground. Most Tibetan houses have a ladder or, in the peasants' cottages, a notched pole which one uses at dire risk to one's shins. These notched poles became very slippery indeed with use. Hands covered with yak's butter transferred it to the pole, and the peasant who forgot, made a rapid descent to the floor below. In 1910, during the Chinese invasion, our house had been partly wrecked and the inner wall of the building was demolished. Father had it rebuilt four stories high. It did not overlook the ring, and we could not look over the head of the Dalai Lama when in procession, so there were no complaints. The gate which gave entrance to our central courtyard was heavy and black with age. Aiders has not been able to force its solid wooden beams, so they had broken down a wall instead. Just above this entrance was the office of the steward. He could see all who entered or left. He engaged, and dismissed, staff and saw that the household was run efficiently. Here, at his window, as the sunset trumpets bled from the monasteries, came the beggars of Lhasa to receive a meal to sustain them through the darkness of the night. The leading nobles made provision for the poor of their district. Often chained convicts would come, for there are few prisons in Tibet, and the convicted wandered the streets and begged for their food. But convicts are not scorned or looked upon as pariahs. We realized that most of us would be convicts if we were found out, so those who were unfortunate were treated reasonably. The monks lived in rooms to the right of the steward. These were the household priests who prayed daily for divine approval of our activities. The lesser nobles had one priest, but our position demanded two. Before any event of note, these priests were consulted and asked to offer prayers for the favor of the gods. Every 3 years the priests returned to the lamasseries and were replaced by others. In each wing of our house there was a chapel. Always the butter lamps were kept burning before the carved wooden altar. The seven bowls of holy water were cleaned and replenished several times a day. They had to be clean, as the gods might want to come and drink from them. The priests were well fed, eating the same food as the family, so that they could pray better and tell the gods that our food was good. To the left of the steward lived the legal expert, whose job it was to see that the household was conducted in a proper and legal manner. Tibetans are very law-abiding, and father had to be an outstanding example in observing the law. We children, brother Palja, sister Yasodhara, and I, lived in the new block, at the side of the square remote from the road. To our left we had a chapel. To the right was the schoolroom which the children of the servants also attended. Our lessons were long and varied. Palja did not inhabit the body long. He was weakly and unfit for the hard life to which we both were subjected. Before he was 7 he left us and returned to the land of many temples. Yaso was 6 when he passed over, and I was 4. I still remember when they came for him as he lay, an empty husk, and how the men of the death carried him away to be broken up and fed to the scavenger birds according to custom. Now heir to the family, my training was intensified. I was 4 years of age and a very indifferent horseman. Father was indeed a strict man, and as a prince of the church he saw to it that his son had stern discipline, and was an example of how others should be brought up. In my country, the higher the rank of a boy, the more severe his training. Of the nobles are beginning to think that boys should have an easier time, but not father. His attitude was, a poor boy had no hope of comfort later, so give him kindness and consideration while he was young. The higher class boy had all riches and comforts to expect in later years, so be quite brutal with him during boyhood and youth, so that he should experience hardship and show consideration for others. This also was the official attitude of the country. Under this system, weaklings did not survive, but those who did could survive almost anything. Tsu occupied a room on the ground floor and very near the main gate. For years he had, as a police monk, been able to see all manner of people, and now he could not bear to be in seclusion, away from it all. He lived near the stables in which Father kept his 20 horses and all the ponies and work animals. The grooms hated the sight of Tsu, because he was officious and interfered with their work. When Father went riding, he had to have 6 armed men escort him. His men wore uniform, and Tsu always bustled about them, making sure that everything about their equipment was in order. For some reason, these 6 men used to back their horses against the wall. Then, as soon as my father appeared on his horse, they would charge forward to meet him. I found that if I leaned out of a storeroom window, I could touch one of the riders as he sat on his horse. One day, being idle, I cautiously passed a rope through his stout leather belt as he was fiddling with his equipment. The two ends I looped and passed over a hook inside the window. In the bustle and talk I was not noticed, and the riders surged forward, 5 of them. The 6th was pulled backwards off his horse, yelling that demons were gripping him. His belt broke, and in the confusion I was able to pull away the rope and steal away undetected. It gave me much pleasure, later, to say so. You too, Needuck, can't stay on a horse. Our days were quite hard. We were awake for 18 hours out of the 24. Hans believed that it is not wise to sleep at all when it is light, or the demons of the day may come and seize one. Even very small babies are kept awake so that they shall not become demon infested. Those who are ill also have to be kept awake, and a monk is called in for this. No one is spared from it. Even people who are dying have to be kept conscious for as long as possible, so that they shall know the right road to take through the borderlands to the next world. At school we had to study languages, Tibetan and Chinese. Tibetan is 2 distinct languages, the ordinary and the honorific. We used the ordinary when speaking to servants and those of lesser rank, and the honorific to those of equal or superior rank. The higher rank person had to be addressed in honorific style. Our autocratic cat, stalking across the courtyard on some mysterious business, would be addressed by a servant: "Would Honorable Puss Puss deign to come and drink this unworthy milk?" No matter how Honorable Puss Puss was addressed, she would never come until she was ready. A schoolroom was quite large. At one time it had been used as a refectory for visiting monks, but since the new buildings were finished, that particular room had been made into a school for the estate. Altogether there were about 60 children attending. We sat cross-legged on the floor, at a table, or long bench, which was about 18 inches high. We sat with our backs to the teacher, so that we did not know when he was looking at us. Thus work hard all the time. Paper in Tibet is handmade and expensive, far too expensive to waste on children. We used slates, large thin slabs about 12 inches by 14 inches. Our pencils were a form of hard chalk which could be picked up in the Sula Hills, some 12,000 feet higher than Lhasa, which was already 12,000 feet above sea level. I used to try to get the chalks with a reddish tint, but Sister Yaso was very, very fond of a soft purple. We could obtain quite a number of colors: reds, yellows, blues, and greens. Colors, I believe, were due to the presence of metallic ores in the soft chalk base. Whatever the cause, we were glad to have them. Arithmetic really bothered me. If 783 monks each drank 52 cups of tsampa per day, and each cup held 5/8 of a pint, what size container would be needed for a week's supply? Aso could do these things and think nothing of it. Well, I was not so bright. I came into my own when we did carving. That was a subject which I liked and could do reasonably well. Carving in Tibet is done from carved wooden plates, and so carving was considered to be quite an asset. Children could not have wood to waste. The wood was expensive as it had to be brought all the way from India. Wood was too tough and had the wrong kind of grain. Used a soft kind of soapstone material, which could be cut easily with a sharp knife. Sometimes we used stale yak cheese. One thing that was never forgotten was a recitation of the laws. These we had to say as soon as we entered the schoolroom, and again, just before we were allowed to leave. These laws were: return good for good, do not fight with gentle people, read the scriptures and understand them, help your neighbors. Law is hard on the rich to teach them understanding and equity, gentle with the poor to show them compassion, pay your debts promptly, so that there was no possibility of forgetting. These laws were carved on banners and fixed to the four walls of our schoolroom. Life was not all study and gloom though. We played as hard as we studied. All our games were designed to toughen us and enable us to survive in hard Tibet with its extremes of temperature. At noon, in summer, the temperature may be as high as 85 degrees Fahrenheit, but that same summer's night it may drop to 40 degrees below freezing. In winter it was often very much colder than this. Archery was good fun and it did develop muscles. We used bows made of yew, imported from India, and sometimes we made crossbows from Tibetan wood. As Buddhists we never shot at living targets. Hidden servants would pull a long string and cause a target to bob up and down. We never knew which to expect. Most of the others could hit the target when standing on the saddle of a galloping pony. I could never stay on that long. Jumps were a different matter. Then there was no horse to bother about. We ran as fast as we could, carrying a 15-foot pole. Then when our speed was sufficient, jumped with the aid of the pole. I used to say that the others stuck on a horse so long that they had no strength in their legs, but I, who had to use my legs, really could vault. It was quite a good system for crossing streams, and very satisfying to see those who were trying to follow me plunge in one after the other. Stilt walking was another of my pastimes. We used to dress up and become giants, and often we would have fights on stilts. The one who fell off was the loser. Our stilts were homemade. We could not just slip round to the nearest shop and buy such things. Used all our powers of persuasion on the keeper of the stores, usually the steward, so that we could obtain suitable pieces of wood. The grain had to be just right, and there had to be freedom from knotholes. Then we had to obtain suitable wedge-shaped pieces of footrests. As wood was too scarce to waste, we had to wait our opportunity and ask at the most appropriate moment. The girls and young women played a form of shuttlecock. A small piece of wood had holes made in one upper edge, and feathers were wedged in. It was kept in the air by using the feet. The girl would lift her skirt to a suitable height to permit a free kicking, and from then on would use her feet only. To touch with the hand meant that she was disqualified. An active girl would keep the thing in the air for as long as 10 minutes at a time before missing a kick. The real interest in Tibet, or at least in the district of Yue, which is the home county of Lhasa, was kite flying. This could be called a national sport. You could only indulge in it at certain times, at certain seasons. Years before it had been discovered that if kites were flown in the mountains, rain fell in torrents. And in those days it was thought that the rain gods were angry, so kite flying was permitted only in the autumn, which in Tibet is the dry season. Certain times of the year, men will not shout in the mountains, as the reverberation of their voices causes the supersaturated rain clouds from India to shed their load too quickly and cause rainfall in the wrong place. On the first day of autumn, a long kite would be sent up from the roof of the potala. Within minutes, kites of all shapes, sizes, and hues made their appearance over Lhasa, bobbing and twisting in the strong breeze. I love kite flying and I saw to it that my kite was one of the first to soar upwards. We all made our own kites, usually with a bamboo framework, and almost always covered with fine silk. Difficulty in obtaining this good quality material. It was a point of honor for the household that the kite should be of the finest class, of box form. We frequently fitted them with a ferocious dragon head and with wings and tail. We had battles in which we tried to bring down the kites of our rivals. We stuck shards of broken glass to the kite string, and covered part of the cord with glue powdered with broken glass in the hope of being able to cut the strings of others and so captured the falling kite. We used to steal out at night and send our kite aloft with little butter lamps inside the head and body. Perhaps the eyes would glow red, and the body would show different colors against the dark night sky. Particularly liked it when the huge yak caravans were expected from the Lodzong district. In our childish innocence we thought that the ignorant natives from far distant places would not know about such modern inventions as our kites, So we used to set out to frighten some wits into them. A device of ours was to put three different shells into the kite in a certain way, so that when the wind blew into them, they would produce a weird wailing sound. We likened it to fire-breathing dragons shrieking in the night, and we hoped that its effect on the traders would be salutary. And many a delicious tingle along our spines as we thought of these men lying frightened in their bedrolls, as our kites bobbed above. Although I did not know it at this time, my play with kites was to stand me in very good stead in later life when I actually flew in them. Now it was but a game, although an exciting one, a game which could have been quite dangerous. We made large kites, big things about 7 or 8 feet square and with wings projecting from two sides. Lay these on level ground near a ravine where there was a particularly strong updraught of air. We would mount our ponies with one end of the cord looped round our waist, and then we would gallop off as fast as our ponies would move. Up into the air jumped the kite, and soaring higher and higher until it met this particular updraught, there would be a jerk and the rider would be lifted straight off his pony, perhaps 10 feet in the air, and sink swaying slowly to earth. Some poor wretches were almost torn in two if they forgot to take their feet from the stirrups, but I, never very good on a horse, could always fall off, and to be lifted was a pleasure. I found, being foolishly adventurous, that if I yanked at a cord at the moment of rising I would go higher, and further judicious yanks would enable me to prolong my flights by seconds. On one occasion I yanked most enthusiastically, the wind cooperated, and I was carried on to the flat roof of a peasant's house upon which was stored the winter fuel. And peasants live in houses with flat roofs with a small parapet, which retains the yak dung, which is dried and used as fuel. This particular house was of dried mud brick instead of the more usual stone, nor was there a chimney. An aperture in the roof served to discharge smoke from the fire below. Sudden arrival at the end of a rope disturbed the fuel, and as I was dragged across the roof, I scooped most of it through the hole onto the unfortunate inhabitants below. Popular, my appearance, also through that hole, was greeted with yelps of rage, and, after having one dusting from the furious householder, I was dragged off to father for another dose of corrective medicine. That night I lay on my face. The next day I had the unsavory job of going through the stables and collecting yak dung, which I had to take to the peasant's house and replace on the roof, which was quite hard work. As I was not yet 6 years of age, none was satisfied except me. The other boys had a good laugh. The peasant now had twice as much fuel, and father had demonstrated that he was a strict and just man. And I spent the next night on my face as well, and I was not sore with horse riding. It may be thought that all this was very hard treatment, but Tibet has no place for weaklings. Lhasa is 12,000 feet above sea level, and with extremes of temperature, other districts are higher, and the conditions even more arduous, and weaklings could very easily imperil others. Reason, and not because of cruel intent. Training was strict. At the higher altitudes people dip newborn babies in icy streams to test if they are strong enough to be allowed to live. Quite often I have seen little processions approaching such a stream, perhaps 17,000 feet above the sea. At its banks the procession will stop, and the grandmother will take the baby. Around her will be grouped the family, father, mother, and close relatives. The baby will be undressed, and grandmother will stoop and immerse the little body in the water, so that only the head and mouth are exposed to the air. In the bitter cold the baby turns red, then blue, and its cries of protest stop. It looks dead, but grandmother has much experience of such things, and the little one is lifted from the water, dried, and dressed. If the baby survives, then it is as the gods decree. If it dies, then it has been spared much suffering on earth. This really is the kindest way in such a frigid country. Far better that a few babies die than that they should be incurable invalids in a country where there is scant medical attention. With the death of my brother it became necessary to have my studies intensified, because when I was 7 years of age I should have to enter upon training for whatever career the astrologers suggested. But everything is decided by astrology, from the buying of a yak to the decision about one's career. Now the time was approaching, just before my 7th birthday, when mother would give a really big party to which nobles and others of high rank would be invited to hear the forecast of the astrologers. Mother was decidedly plump, She had a round face and black hair. Tibetan women wear a sort of wooden framework on their head, and over this the hair is draped to make it as ornamental as possible. Frames were very elaborate affairs. They were frequently of crimson lacquer, studded with semi-precious stones and inlaid with jade and coral.